morning, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. Today, the next talk will be about processing planetary-sized data sets. It will be delivered by Tim Park from Microsoft. I would like to ask you to give a big round of applause, and so we may begin with the session.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about processing geospatial data sets today, but I thought I would start just by briefly taking a look at, you know, where we've been as a computing industry. How is the sound? Is it really too loud, or is it booming? That's okay? Okay, great. So in the beginning, there was a computer, and it filled the whole room. This is the ENIAC, and it was one of the first computers. It did computation at the blazing speed of 360 calculations a second. Apparently it required a room full of suits in order to kind of keep it running. But it was really instrumental in calculating, you know, the ability of neutrons to penetrate matter and hit a nucleus. And the way that they did this is they actually devised and developed a technique that we still use today called the Monte Carlo method. The Monte Carlo method is randomly sampling a problem in order to come up with a solution. And so in order to solve this very practical problem, they came up with this solution, the Monte Carlo method. And over the next, decade or two, there was thousands of times, the computers are thousands of times smaller. There's thousands of times more people actively building stuff. And that led to people like Kernighan and Ritchie here, who built the C programming language. They built, they did a lot of the work on developing some of the first Unixes. And that was all driven out of the practical need to essentially solve these telephony level issues that they had. And so we still model a lot of our programming languages and our operating systems, obviously, off of this work. The PC was the next thing in this. This put the hands of computing in the hands of ordinary people. It led to a wide reinvention of things like going from typewriters to word processors, going from inventory management and accounting systems to spreadsheets. And the really big point here is that every stage of this evolution, as software engineers have kind of come up with best practices and methods for processing things. So the same way we built file systems for Excel spreadsheets and B-trees for databases, we've done this at every step of the way to move things forward. And obviously the mobile phone has taken that a step forward, right? And so that's kind of the latest, kind of really quantum leap we've made in computing, in my opinion. And while a lot of people will talk about it being around the app stores that you've created, in my opinion, the most interesting thing is that it's taking computing out into the real world. And so this has enabled a whole bunch of new applications, right? It's super obvious to us now, but now we have a map of the world in our pocket. Probably 20 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to believe that, or that we could be able to push a button on a phone and a car will show up 10 meters away. These are things that essentially the computing being out in the real world has enabled us to do. And so in the same way that our predecessors had to figure out and learn how to process structured data and build databases, the explosion of mobile and the fact that many mobile apps really revolve around this real world means that increasingly processing and analyzing this sort of geospatial data is going to be woven into a lot of the applications that we're building as developers. So I work in our developer advocacy team at Microsoft, and what that really means is I go out and work with a lot of our customers and partners on their harder technical challenges. And one of the key focuses that I have is on what we call high-scale data, so the kind of the scale of data that we use, things like Hadoop, Spark, and beyond to process, but then also geospatial. And so today I'm going to talk about some of these projects that we've done and some of the things we've learned and some of the patterns that we've seen in them. And so the first project I wanted to talk to you about and share with you is one that is around a geospatial project we did with a large transportation company here in Europe. This is a pretty well-known transportation company, unfortunately I can't share, collects location traces for a bunch of truck deliveries they do. And so every time their truck goes out to deliver packages, they essentially keep a track of what, the speeds that it had and the elevations it at and the timestamped location data. And so not very surprisingly, this data set sort of looks like this. It has a vehicle ID. Each of the trips that vehicle ID take are numbered as well, and then a whole bunch of timestamped location and altitude data. And so they have many, many vehicles, all who take many, many trips, all that have many, many locations. And so it's probably not very hard for you to imagine that they really end up with a ton of data, literally. And so we worked with them on a monthly data slice of this, which essentially was 39 terabytes of raw location data. And this kind of broke down into having 116 million trips that all these vehicles took, and 584 billion data points. And so the point here is that, you know, just even on a monthly slice, this is already a data problem that's kind of beyond what we can use a typical computing node in the cloud or otherwise to solve. And so we need to think about kind of larger scale data storage. We start thinking about this over years and decades in terms of the data that they'd have. And so let's first talk about, you know, how we'd go about storing this data. And so the trip, as I mentioned before, has an ordered set of locations. They're ordered by timestamp. And so to display a trip, this is one of the key things they wanted to be able to do. In other words, others, they need to be able to essentially pull a kind of do a range query on that location data. And so they need, from their data, their data storage system, they need to be able to pull a particular set of locations. This is, for any of you who've worked in this space, and I suspect many of you have, a pretty large challenge for a data set of the size that can grow up into the petabytes. There's a number of ways you can solve it. Some people, especially in the early days, solved this by essentially hand sharding databases, spreading the data across a number of clusters, and then using, you know, pulling data out from individual things. We also looked at with them, one of the key things they wanted to do is use a hosted service. They didn't want to be managing the data platform themselves. So we actually looked at a hosted platform from MongoDB to do that. It worked, however, it was very expensive given the amount of data that they wanted to be able to store. And so what we actually ended up working with them on, we ended up using, another thing they wanted to do is they wanted to use an open platform. And so we actually used Apache HBase to do this. And this is something we've seen across a number of projects. And so whether I use HBase or Cassandra or a cloud solution, is using something that I would describe as lightly structured storage. So something that for geospatial data and the location data itself, being able to store it in a manner that's very cost efficient yet kind of satisfies the need to be able to do some of these simple queries like retrieve locations by a range of timestamps against the storage platform. But when we started looking at something like trip storage, they had a much more complicated set of queries they wanted to be able to do against it. They wanted to be able to say, like, give me the number of trips under 10 kilometers in length near Dublin, or give me all the trips over an hour near Berlin. And so you start looking at having multiple dimensions on the queries they want to do against that, and also that there's a geospatial aspect to it. And that means that, you know, from our standpoint, it was harder to do that with HBase. And so in this case, we actually used Postgres. And that's kind of the second pattern that we've seen, and we've seen this beyond the geospatial space. The fact that you now have kind of these hosted storage platforms on the cloud or otherwise, if you can build your own internally as well using, you know, things like Kubernetes or Mesos, means that you can start using the best storage system, and you should use the best storage system that matches the requirements of your particular application or problem space. So in this case, we used the location data we stored in HBase, and then the trip data, because we wanted this much richer level of ability to query against it, we stored in Postgres. And we were able to use Postgres and PostGIS because the amount of trip data we had was several orders of magnitude lower than the location data. And so it still fit on a typical scaled cluster of Postgres. So the second pattern is just choose the best storage system for your particular application's needs. We've talked about how we stored that data. Kind of one of the other requirements they had is they wanted to be able to do a heat map over the whole data set across multiple time dimensions, so a kind of weekly and a monthly and on a yearly basis and all time, to see where their trucks were spending time. And this is really interesting especially on an hour level basis. They could really see trends and patterns that maybe weren't obvious to them before, just from an intuitive level. And doing heat mapping, this is pretty prevalent across large data sets like this. And so we also work with Ströer, who's a large advertiser in Germany. They do a lot of the advertising that's on at the street level, physical advertising. So when you're walking through an urban center, you see these kind of circular advertising. And one of the key things that they wanted to be able to do is take a number of geolocated data sets. And so, for instance, Twitter, Instagram, some of these open public geolocated data sets and mine emotions out of them, especially around brands, but overall emotions for people that are living in these areas, because that's very important for advertising. If you know somebody has a positive sentiment about something, you would advertise to them differently than if they have a negative sentiment. And so they built a heat map like this that they could drill in at a very fine level and see how what they should do with different advertising campaigns. And so building heat maps like this is a pretty common problem. And so I'm going to talk about the way that the transportation company did it, just because it's a much easier problem to talk about. But basically what they did is they basically summed up the number of location samples that were over a particular geolocated area. And so in that case, they essentially used squares that kind of cover the planet in order to kind of sum up what the density of trucks looks like at any particular time. And so for every location that a truck sends back, we attribute that location to one of these geo summaries, and then sum up all the locations over that summary. And the mechanism that we use to do that, and it's kind of a pattern we've used extensively across a number of projects, is to use XYZ tiles. These have a couple different names, but this is the same set of tiles. For those of you who've done anything with Google Maps or OpenStreetMaps or Apple Maps, these are the same tile addressing system that those projects use as well, or systems. And essentially, it's a pretty simple system. It divides up recursively divides up the world. And so at zoom level one, you take the whole planet and you divide it up into four sections. And so this top right tile is zoom level one, so tile one underscore row zero underscore column one. And that's essentially the addressing scheme that it uses. And then it proceeds kind of recursively from there. And so you divide up the next, you divide up that level one tile to get level two, you divide up into other squares. And so 200 is the second zoom level tile, and then so on and so on. And so we use this to do that summarization. But what you can see is that, essentially working over, in order to do a heat map like this, that you essentially end up with operating over the whole data set. And so what we used to work across that whole data set in this project was Apache Spark. I don't think I have to explain it too much to this particular audience. Most people used are familiar with Apache Spark, And so I like to think of it as Hadoop Next Generation. I think it's better performance, has a better programming model. This particular customer was using Microsoft Azure, so we used a hosted version of Apache Spark that we have on Azure called HD Insight Spark, just so we didn't have to run our own cluster. Since a lot of people have experience with it, essentially the way we did this problem at a algorithmic level was to essentially map all these locations that were coming in from the truck to these set of tile IDs. And so we did it from zoom level 10, which you can think of as a province level, down to 18, zoom level 18, which would correspond to a neighborhood level. And we did that for all those. We did that for that range of tiles because we knew what the UI needed, essentially. So that was just kind of arbitrarily chosen based on what we needed to display in the UI. And so having done these mappings, essentially we give a vote for every time a truck was in one of those tiles. We give a vote of one, and then essentially very MapReduce style, we essentially sum up all of those using Apache Spark to come up with the aggregate value for one of those tiles. The actual algorithm was a little bit more complex because we actually also mapped to all the different time ranges that we wanted to cover, so week level, a month level, year level, and whatnot, but just to keep it simple. One of the things I talk about with other audiences that aren't as familiar with Spark is just how easy it is to do something in Spark, and so this is the code we use to do the mapping ID, mapping tile IDs to the tile they belong to, and just how easy something like this ends up being in Spark. You know, so boiling down, you know, just doing a basic computation of a heat map using Spark is amazingly simple in Spark. I think it's a testament to this community how easy it is to do something on a problem this big. So even though there's terabytes of data, essentially it worked. It boils down to a fairly easy program to build in Apache Spark. One of the things, though, when you work in a problem space like this is, of course, the data set you're working on is not static, right? There's trucks are always making more deliveries. There's more data coming in. And so one of the things we also did as part of this project is actually extend what I just talked about to enable what we describe as incremental ingestion. And so this is pretty funny because you're watching the keynote today, I'm like, oh, wow, everybody kind of has the same, you know, it's kind of this hour level, especially when it's someone like that's working on Apache Flink. But essentially, that's the same problem we're talking about here. And so all this trip data is coming in. For those of you who use Spark kind of extensively, you know that it operates much better on much bigger files. And so one of the things that we did as part of this project is to take all these trips that were coming in, feed them into Apache Kafka, and essentially run an hourly archival job to spit out these blobs that then we would then process using the algorithm that I just talked about. This enables you get the efficiencies of Spark. It also allows you to have, you know, all this incoming data. And so the processing of this then, many of you probably have guessed this already, but essentially we operate over that particular slice of data. And so each heat map that we wanted to compute, we essentially operate over that 1 hour level data to come up with a partial heat map. It turns out from there, for their particular application, this is really interesting just by itself. They like to see the 1 hour level heat map. And so we save that off as well. But then we also have a second stage in comparison to the algorithm I talked about before. We actually map that into the other time ranges that it corresponds to. And so we combine it with the other heat maps to write out the latest version of these heat maps. One thing that maybe isn't, you know, completely apparent in when I discuss it this way is that that doing it this way also, you know, it saves orders of magnitude time in terms of I/O and computation, of course, because this heat map is greatly summarized version of this original data, and so it folding the existing heat map in with the heat map partial is a much simpler operation than doing a one stage over the entire data set. And so even though it's two stages that have to happen here in the process, it's a couple of orders of magnitude quicker. One of the other projects we did is we worked with the United Nations office in Geneva and New York. So we have teams there that were working with them around their sub-office of humanitarian affairs. And so this part of the UN is tasked with getting help to vulnerable people in the midst of humanitarian crises. So we worked with them to see how, you know, we could have helped them during the humanitarian crisis that was happening during the Libyan civil war that's been ongoing since 2014. They have kind of equal remits to help with natural disasters and armed conflicts. Unfortunately, these two things tend to yield sort of similar results, kind of devastated civilian infrastructure, refugees that are seeking shelter and food. And kind of the sad state of things is that the way that they kind of detect where the actual help is needed is a lot of people on the ground kind of talking with people and seeing what's going on. So, for instance, a photojournalist might be documenting the event, run into people that have very specific needs or things that are lacking, and then the UN can kick into gear and coordinate humanitarian relief. But this is obviously a very slow approach, and it can be days before people can get help. And so, fortunately, the UN had an idea for how to improve on this, one of the kind of amazing things about developing nations, I don't know how many people are familiar with this, but they actually have a higher level of mobile penetration than many developed worlds or developed countries. And so the Libya is like that. And so the UN's idea was, could we process some of this incoming Twitter traffic, other short message systems, to essentially be able to dashboard and look for keywords malnutrition or things like that in the native language and essentially have a dashboard for where problems could be occurring. And so we worked with them on this project. One of the key requirements they had, though, is they didn't just want the dashboard, but they also wanted to have these events intersected with the real-world places. And so, for instance, they wanted to be able to detect that the green squares, which are in the Benghazi province, were actually part of the Benghazi province and have kind of a summarization over these real-world political boundaries that exist. This is a pretty complicated problem. Political boundaries have kind of irregular lines. And so it doesn't boil down to just using a set of squares and doing joins in Spark, unfortunately. But the way we solved it, we did utilize the XYZ tile concept that I talked about before. And the way we did it is we essentially mapped the Benghazi province to a bounding tile, then also used a variety of zoom levels against the incoming messages to essentially intersect them with the corresponding candidate OpenStreetMap features. And so this here I'm demonstrating that essentially we used a very coarse level tile to kind of eliminate tweets that are obviously not in Benghazi, and the blue square is an example of that. And then ones that fall inside the bounding tile, like the red tweet, we then use a fine grain intersection against Benghazi province's boundary to actually determine whether or not they're inside and outside of the box. And so we did this to begin for the whole project with Spark. As I mentioned at the beginning, one of the key things that we wanted to be able to do was be able to make these detections in real time, or something that was close to real time. And while we could have done that with something like Apache Spark Streaming, what we ended up doing was actually implementing a Lambda architecture. How many people are familiar with Lambda architectures? Okay, great. Yeah. All right, great. That's a lot more than usual. That's great. So a Lambda architecture essentially marries two things. So we have this kind of batch path, which goes along the top, which is what I just talked about, and what I talked about with the heat map, which is using something like Apache Hadoop or Apache Spark to kind of come up with this whatever you're trying to compute. But then they have what's called a speed layer that runs along the bottom that takes real-time events and uses that to update the data set that you computed using a batch method. And what this allows you to do, because a lot of people will ask, well, why don't you just use a speed layer, is it allows you to go back and recompute you have new data, it allows you to recompute against the other data stream. So for instance, if OpenStreetMaps adds more geographical boundaries within Libya, we can go back and recompute the intersections of those using the batch layer and then continue with the speed layer to keep those up to date. And so for the speed layer, we also use we use Apache Storm to do this. We use, again, a hosted version of it that we have in Microsoft Azure. And essentially, we did this as a tweet came in. We have an intersection service that was able to do, was built on top of a Postgres database, essentially did feature intersections that it spit out and essentially updated the existing data set. And so we had a mechanism where we could update the database essentially that was feeding that dashboard and do it on a fairly real-time basis. Kind of the latency through the system was something on the order of minutes, and instead of kind of running a whole batch job, it was on the order of a couple minutes that we could see a tweet would come through and it would affect the dashboard. And so Apache Storm was fantastic for this. I'm at the keynote today. I'm super excited to give Flink a try as well. But this was something we had. It was hosted. It was fabulous. So, and this in general, this technique, this Lambda technique, worked really well for us in the project. So it gave us the ability to go back and recompute, but then also have this kind of real time update that they wanted. So the last thing I want to talk about today, which may I think for people that are doing geospatial stuff is really interesting, is how you go about displaying these heat maps. And so when you look at this, if you look at this from kind of a front end perspective, you think about how do I get all of that data into the browser. And you might have suspected when you saw that, that you know, if you built an API that you did a bounding box query, you could end up sending down a lot of data, which would be slow. And maybe it didn't scale very well on the server. And so one of the things that we did as part of this project was actually to, when we see another project, is actually to pre-compute the heat maps. And that can take a couple different forms. Because they wanted to do some processing, the transportation company wanted to do some processing down on the client itself, we utilized the XYZ tile concept again to actually batch together all of the results into these higher level result sets. And so for every square that we had down below that higher level tile, we essentially captured that up. The browser would make a request, so if you're on this particular view, it would make a request for all six of these different result sets and then aggregate them together in order to display it. That sounds like it's really complex for not a lot of gain, but what it really allows you to do is it allows you to both turn this problem from a serving or an API problem into a serving JSON problem. And so we took all these result sets and stored them in blob storage. And so we could serve this application straight out of blob storage. It also allows the browser to cache all these different things, and it was super effective from a performance standpoint. And we did this again using the same pipeline we had built to build the heat maps. Essentially, we just looked at the heat map deltas to be able to kind of determine which of these result sets needed to be updated, and then use Spark to essentially push out these updates to these particular data views that we wanted to update. Finally, the one kind of random thing, which I just noticed has a non sequitur number, is to use binary encoding. I don't know how many of you have already discovered this, but yeah, using something like Avro just makes life a lot better. How many are familiar with Avro? Protobufs, okay. Avro, Protobufs, something like that, something that's kind of an extensible binary encoding. We've used that in a number of projects, and it almost universally, obviously, kind of linearly makes your things run faster. And so instead of having to parse the JSON, it already has a schema and kind of linearly cuts into your data storage costs as well. So that's it. That's all I had. I'm happy to take questions. I also have, we open sourced a lot of work. I'll share my slides on Twitter for those of you who don't have to take pictures or you can. But we open sourced a lot of the work that we did, some of the generic work we did as some of these projects. We did a GeoTile, which is the XYZ tile math in a couple of different languages. The heat map code is we open sourced as well. So I'm happy to take questions. Love to talk more about it. Thanks for coming. Yeah.
So anyone have any questions?
Hey, So the question is about Avro versus JSON performance.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Is it compressed size gain or uncompressed?
Yeah, so what Avro does, so this is really close to go back, essentially, it's a schema approach. So if you have an integer, instead of it having it be a whole bunch of ASCII or UTF-8, bytes, it's essentially stores it as a 64-bit integer. And so it takes 64 bits versus whatever. It also, I believe, has, it doesn't have to have like the, in JSON you have the name of the field and then the value, right? So the key and the value. It doesn't have to have all of that because it knows the schema that the data is in. For our data set, it was 60% smaller overall because of all of those things. And so when it's sitting in blob storage in particular, you essentially say, most cloud or even if you're on premise with storage, that's essentially how much you can save in terms of storage as well. And then you're working with Spark, a lot of the, unless you're working on a really complicated algorithm, this obviously wasn't, most of the time your job takes to run is just kind of moving the data around, right? And so this means that it has to move 60% less data around. Yeah.
Any questions?
When you were showing your heat maps, Did you compute them using some kind of aggregate values for the trips using all the values of the trip?
Yes, I should have mentioned that. So we also, as part of that job, we compute and keep track of kind of the the min, max, and mean of the of all the, I think that's what you're asking for, for the particular level that's being displayed. So you could do a so you could do the coloring relative to that. Is that what you're asking?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So any last questions, anyone?
I'll be up here if anybody wants to talk one-on-one about anything. I'll be up here and happy to answer questions.
So thanks for the session, Tim.
No problem.
Let's have a final round of applause for the presenter.
Thanks, thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.